we can't rely on it. The time is prime, planets aligning, no mistaking. For union resurrection, the anger has awakened. Has awakened. The sleeping giant, come on, yeah, we can do it. We need to revive, re-amp, and re-up the labor movement.
Anything welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, ricksmithshow.com. So as I said, 114 years ago today, our Supreme Court, in one of the worst decisions ever, decided that working people be damned, and the 60-hour work week was just too onerous for the bakers, the bakery owners in New York, and ruled that maximum hour law unconstitutional. And again, it's the same language, the same rhetoric that they used then, just updated for today. We no longer talk about liberty of contract. It's now freedom. Freedom to contract. And you got to give them credit. They do at least change the rhetoric up a little bit. But here to share some thoughts on this anniversary. Also, maybe talk about some of the things that are going up in New England. And the return of the sun up to sundown workday. I've asked Eric Loomis to come talk with us. He's a professor, historian, blogger at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and the author of the fantastic book, A History of America in 10 Strikes. Eric, thanks for taking some time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, what are we? This is the 114th anniversary of the Lochner decision. I argue probably the worst decision in Supreme, one of the worst decisions in Supreme Court history.
There are many really bad decisions. That's a high bar, but Lochner is definitely at the very top of them because, as you accurately described, it effectively ruled that workers have no rights in America, and that laws to protect workers were unconstitutional because they got in the way of workers to have the freedom to work 70 or 80 or 90 hours a week.
Exactly. And we've gotten used to, I say this all the time, we've taken for granted the idea that a 40-hour work week is the standard, that an 8-hour day is how things are. We've kind of taken it for granted, and it's unfortunately slipping away from us.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, first people forget just how much struggle went into the 8-hour day and how that was a really core demand for the history of American labor going, not only to the 1880s, but even earlier than that. We think of Haymarket being around the 8-hour day and the Knights of Labor, but they weren't the ones who invented that. I mean, so people fought and died for that, and it is slipping away, and we see, more and more people being put on salary and being forced to work, 12 and 14-hour days and all of the complexities of the modern scheduling, and so many people having less than 40 hours or not knowing their schedule week to week, and this on-call scheduling and all these other things that really undermine the ability of workers to control their own lives. And,
yeah.
and it's a very bad thing. And, the Supreme Court then declared that these kinds of laws to regulate worker hours are unconstitutional. And I fear that our current Supreme Court could do the same thing in the future.
No, I fully expect that to happen. Because, I've talked to conservatives who, don't think that the Lochner decision was bad. They think it was the right decision, and they think that we should be right back there. And I guess it's which side of the divide that you're on. Are you on the side of the person working the sun up to sundown schedule or the Jack Ma 996 plan? Or are you on the side of the guy making somebody work the 996 plan?
Yeah, I mean, when Republicans talk about, poor children, for instance, cleaning bathrooms before school, they're serious about this, right? This is an actual idea that they have, that they push. This is their goal, and they're not hiding it, right? All you have to do is read Republican websites and conservative blogs and, everything else in that conservative media world to understand that the goal is to recreate Lochner. That is their ideal society. And I don't think we take that seriously enough because every year they move closer and closer to recreating that.
Yeah. You said on Twitter today that you don't think most people, even those on the left who are often smart, really know just how terrible the past was and how serious conservatives are in recreating that past. And I think that, that really sums up where we are today politically.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, the Supreme Court is the most important institution in the country. And, the Supreme Court literally decides life or death. I mean, in the case of death penalty cases, which we see now all the time, with the Supreme Court denying reprieves for people on death row, I mean, in a very literal way, but also in a more long-term way. And I think that, most people ultimately who who are, you know, writing, whether it's on Twitter or blogs, reporters, whatever, they don't really understand how bad things could get. Ultimately, they think things are going to be okay. And I think that the biggest lesson of the present is that they are probably not going to be okay for a lot of people. And that you have to think in a long-term strategy about how to defeat the people trying to recreate Lochner and recreate so many other terrible things about the past, because they have a long-term strategy to repeal the New Deal, to repeal the Great Society, to repeal the gains of the civil rights movement, and the feminist movement, and all these other social movements. And they are succeeding in many ways, slowly but surely, in doing that. And until we get serious to fight that back and have our own long-term strategy, they're going to continue to win this game.
No, you're absolutely right, and it's scary that they're going to take us back to the good old days of the 1880s and 1890s and look, it wasn't good for working people, it wasn't good for minorities, and it wasn't good for white people either. It was really good for the very wealthy and the very well-to-do and the well-connected, but the rest of society, not so much.
No, that's right. I mean, you know, if you look at, say, the 1890s and why people started to reform and started to fix things, it was because anarchists were walking up to our presidents and shooting them in the stomach, such as happened to William McKinley.
Right.
Right. It's because, you know, workers were so desperate, they were bombing anti-union newspapers, such as what happened to the Los Angeles Times in 1910. I mean, when people feel no hope in their lives, they will turn to violence, and people realize that, even middle-class people realize that in the 1900s and 1910s, and that's what leads to the progressives, you know, and you begin to see some movement thanks to workers agitating and other people realizing that these workers are right, and things maybe very slowly start getting better. And now, you know, as people get more and more desperate, will they return to ways of protesting that we thought were left behind? I mean, we'd like to think they wouldn't have to be in that position, but if this continues, who knows what the future holds?
Yeah, I keep saying that, you know, unfortunately, my children are going to have to fight the battles that my grandparents and great-grandparents had to fight. And I don't know if you saw the 60-minute piece with the billionaire Ray Dalio a couple of weeks ago.
No, I did not.
Where he said that if he were president, he would declare income inequality a national emergency. Because as he said at the end of it, he goes, look, there's going to be conflict in the streets. When there's desperation, there's going to be conflict. And we don't know where that goes, where that takes us. Now, I got to imagine from his point of view, when the pitchforks come out and heads are on platters, chances are it's going to be his head on the platter. So I get the self-interest of the statement, but still to have him come out and say that he would declare income inequality a national emergency at this moment, I think is pretty important.
Well, I agree. I mean, the smart capitalist realized that, that having unions, having limited income inequality ultimately serve their long-term interests. Creating a stable society with solid profits, you know, that is in their long-term interest. But let's face it, a lot of capitalists these days aren't very smart. They're just purely greedy. You know, it starts at the Oval Office, right? I mean, you know, and it goes all the way down into, you know, middle management and into, you know, too many small business owners and things like this, where it really is today all about pure greed. And people, you know, seem to think that, well, you know, you can continue to take rights away from workers, and you can, you know, you can make their health care more and more expensive, and you can destroy their benefits and everything else, and there's not going to be a backlash. But I think we're already starting to see the backlash. I mean,
yeah.
You see so many strikes today. There's been so many successful strikes recently. You're beginning to see workers really wake up to these problems and beginning to, you know, I think beginning to push back in a real way against them.
No, and the perfect example is right now going on up in the New England states, where you've got 31,000 grocery store workers for Stop and Shop, you know, on strike against a company, Ahold, who, you know, made, you know, $2 billion in profit last year, and over the past 2 years got $500 million plus in tax breaks. And then just this year alone, $1.1 billion in stock buybacks. And now they're saying, no, you got to pay more for your insurance, and we're going to cut your wages. And look, the workers said, no, we're going to the strike line, and good on them, as they should have. But, you know, this is where we are right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think this untrammeled greed and, you know, the attempt to simply repeal any kind of union rights is just far too common. And this is actually a really important strike. I mean, you know, Stop and Shop and the grocery industry, you know, it's a still a fairly significantly unionized industry for the private sector, and, you know, much more so than a whole lot of other lines of employment. And if they win this strike, I mean, if the company, if they defeat the union, that begins to set a standard of taking away health care throughout the, you know, throughout these, you know, these groceries that are organized by the United Food and Commercial Workers. And I think everybody knows that. And, you know, being here in New England, you know, I at Stop and Shop all the time. And, you know, I went out last weekend, and engaged in a solidarity action, walked the picket line with those workers, was talking to those workers. And, you know, they're very nervous. They're scared, but they are also showing a tremendous amount of bravery. You know, they know what this is about. And even though they're not that well paid and they're not, and the strike kind of came out of nowhere, they didn't have a whole lot of savings. It's not as if the union told them, hey, start saving your money, we think we're going to go on strike.
Right.
But the company was so unwilling to negotiate and continues to be unwilling to negotiate a full weekend that it's putting a lot of burden on these workers, and yet they're standing strong, and Stop and Shop is really losing a ton of money right now.
Yeah, but, you know, look, as someone who's been on strike a couple of times, I completely understand it. But I always, and I tell you know, young guys who join the union now, as an old timer told me, the first thing that you do before you start living on the kind of money that you're making is put 6 months in bills away, because you never know when you're going to have to walk across that threshold to defend what you've earned and what, you know, past workers have fought and bled and died for. And, you know, it's one of those things that I stick to. And I think every working person should think that way, because look, yeah, this is a big company. They can last a long time to starve you out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the open question here. How much money are they willing to lose? Because, you know, this is Passover week, Easter is on Sunday, and, you know, even the Stop and Shops that are open, and there's not, and a lot of them have closed. And when I was out on the picket line, I would say 30-40% of the cars who attempted to drive in realized what was going on and turned around. So that's pretty positive. But even for those people who were still crossing the picket lines, there's nothing left in the Stop and Shops to buy. And a big part of this, and this is an important point, is thank God for the Teamsters who refused to cross the picket lines and refused to make deliveries to these stores. And so, you know, they're basically, they, you know, there's no meat, there's no vegetables, they're out of almost everything. And so it really depends how much is this company willing to lose, because they are absolutely getting shredded right now. And a lot of industry analysts who look at, you know, the grocery store industry are talking about just how remarkably successful so far this strike has been in holding the line and in really putting a dent into the pocket of this company. So, you know, we'll see, but there is reason to be optimistic.
Yeah, but ultimately, and I talked about this last night, to me, this also is about educating the public on just what you said. You know, the Teamsters are part of this. And I remember, you know, my contract when I was working under the National Master Freight Agreement actually had a clause in there that no matter what, we didn't cross a picket line. So we had contractual protection against if there was a picket line, you never crossed it. And, you know, to me, this is one of those moments, you know, educationally, because there haven't been a lot of strikes over the last, you know, couple of decades. This is an opportunity to educate the public of how we as a community have to stand together.
Well, and I think that's an important thing, an important point of what's been going on here in the last 12 to 18 months. You know, strikes were, of course, at all-time lows for years and years, the 90s, the 2000s, into the teens. You know, there were not a lot of strikes. And in the last 18 months, it's really begun to change. You know, last year, 2018, had the most strikes, or most workers on strike since, I believe, 1986. Now, of course, there was a huge decline between, say, 1981, when the air traffic controllers were busted, and 1986.
Right.
So we're far away from those 1970s levels that were, you know, really at, you know, were so, so high. But yet that is still very significant. More people are seeing people on strike than they have in 32, 33 years. And those strikes have been successful, mostly with the teachers, but other strikes as well. And the more those are successful, the more people see others walking the picket line, the more they feel confident in defending their own rights at work, and the more we, again, reteach the American public what it means to be in a union, what solidarity means, what standing up for other workers means. And we're a long ways, again, we're a long ways from the 1970s, but still, we have to feel good about the progress that has been made in terms of publicly visible strikes in the last 18 months.
Well, absolutely. And the other part of this, and I think back to, I have relatives who have never been in a union, but are big union supporters, because they understand, look, if you're making decent wages, if you've got decent working conditions, decent benefits, it's going to benefit this whole society, even people who will never be in a union. And the kind of support that at least my family members give to unions is incredible. And I think it's something that as a society, we have to relearn. And the concept of solidarity is something that has to be relearned.
I could not agree with you more. I think, you know, that's something we've struggled with a lot in many ways over the last few decades, such a strong impact of individualism on our society that sometimes gets in the way of solidarity. And leads to a lot of infighting and bickering between people who should be allies because they're only looking out for themselves. Sometimes that's been an issue. But I do think that, I think one thing about the president is that so many people feel economically insecure. Forget about the unemployment numbers. Yes, they're low, and that matters. But the actual lived experience of the economy is not very good for most people. And they realize that everybody else is in the same boat as they are. And that's part of the reason the teacher strikes have been so successful, because they're fighting for their communities, not just for their paycheck. And when people see these Stop and Shop workers, they realize that could easily be them, or it is them. It's people they know. And even if it's not, they see the poverty around them. They see the low wages. They know people who are struggling with health care debt, student debt, you know, child care, all of these things. And the experience of economic insecurity is one that actually ties a whole lot of people together today. And I think that contributes to this sort of reawakening of solidarity that we may be seeing now.
Yeah. The other part of this, though, Eric, is, you know, the reality is most of the workers that I know, especially younger workers who have been saddled with, you know, a lifetime of student loan debt that they're probably never going to get out from under. And they're walking into a job market that is supposed to be the best, in according to Trump, the best ever. And yet they're working, you know, gig economy jobs, they're working minimum wage jobs, they're trying to cobble together some bit of a living and ability to pay their bills. To me, right now is one of those moments where you begin organizing these folks into whatever the union movement's going to look like moving forward to address these gig economy jobs and the automation tsunami that's coming.
No, I agree. And I think certainly more could be done. I think that, whatever the union movement looks like going forward, you know, I do think that there is going to be various kinds of organizing, say, in the gig economy. You know, we've seen Uber and Lyft drivers in places like Los Angeles begin to start organizing. Yes, I think it would be great if a union, a big international union, put a lot of resources into starting to organize these people. I think they would probably have a lot of success in doing so. I understand, you know, in an era where you don't have a lot of resources compared to how you used to, why maybe that hasn't happened. But I think that certainly this is absolutely the time, because, look, another recession is coming. And, you know, I think that one of the reasons why in 2008 nothing really happened to the bankers is that the left itself was not very organized and did not have concrete demands at the time. And I feel like in the 10 years since, with Occupy, with the Bernie campaign, with now the teacher strikes, a whole lot of other issues, the left has sort of been reinvigorating itself, figuring out where to go from here, having those necessary conversations, beginning to build power. We're starting to see that power come to fruition. And hopefully, when that next recession comes, and so many of these people with huge amounts of debt, you know, the economy may collapse or struggle, you have higher unemployment, hopefully we're ready to act in a more concrete way than we were in 2008 and make real demands on our politicians and hold them accountable in a way we absolutely did not in 2008.
No, you're right. And, you know, 2008, I had hoped that would be one of those wake-up moments as millions of people lost their homes and their jobs and their life savings. I had hoped that would be that moment to where, you know, the organizing that happened after the Great Depression happened. But you're right. You know, all through before the Depression and during, there was tons of on-the-ground organizing and building of organization that we just didn't have at that point. And I think we have some capacity now. I think you're right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it doesn't compare to the 1930s. I agree. And as you point out, you know, by the time of the Great Depression, you had decades of significant organizing, and a lot of it had been crushed, you know, and cases like Lochner certainly didn't help. And we don't have that exactly today. But I do think that we are building more than we have in a very, very long time, more been since the 1970s, basically, was the last time, I think, that you've seen a significant, you know, a buildup of organizing capacity that or challenges to power that compares to today. So in the long term, maybe we're less optimistic if we look back to the 1930s, but if we compare to the 80s, to the 90s, to the 2000s, we actually should be optimistic compared to those times.
Yeah, good point. Last question I've got for you, because, you know, I look at this and, you know, we're in a really interesting time in our history. And, I like to compare, how things, because I try and study as much of labor's history as I can. But the fact that, labor's history has been almost eviscerated. We did a tour back in 2013 where we went across the country. And one of the main things that we learned is that corporate America has done a great job of not just removing history entirely, but rewriting what is left. And I look at the current, left organizations that are out there. Labor doesn't seem to be first and foremost, on their minds, or if it's on their minds at all. Do you worry that, maybe that gets left off of the more progressive agenda?
I think it depends on what kind of progressive agenda we're talking about. I think within the Democratic Party, I don't have a lot of faith per se that if the Democrats win in 2020. That a big labor law reform, for instance, is going to be a top priority. But then you look at a lot of left-leaning organizations that are focused on things broadly, like income inequality. They may not be union issues per se, although unions are impacted by this, but I think that there is a greater emphasis on economic inequality than there has been in a long time. I think that Occupy was a big part of that. Again, Bernie was a big part of that. The rise of DSA has been a part of that. And there's a lot of competing interests within a broader progressive movement. There's no question about that. There's a lot of issues that need to be worked on. Immigration is a huge issue. Climate change is a huge issue. These are all gargantuan issues. I don't know which one's going to win out or become a top priority. But I do think there's plenty of reason to believe that at the very least, grassroots efforts to push for economic change are going to have an impact. And you have, at the very least, between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, two significant potential front-running Democratic Party candidates who are going to be very focused on those issues. And that, at the very least, is telling. I mean, think if Bernie or Warren became the nominee, economic issues are going to be the number one agenda. Yeah. Other people, maybe less so.
And good on Elizabeth Warren for her support of the strikers up there in New England, and good on Bernie for his statement at the Machinists Convention of repealing Taft-Hartley and banning right-to-work laws. I mean, there's hope. So
yeah, and for what it's worth, Biden is doing a visit to the striking Stop and Shop workers tomorrow.
Right.
So I think that's a positive thing too.
Yeah, he's not officially in yet, so I didn't include him.
Yeah, fair enough.
So when he jumps in and he's officially a candidate, and the longer he waits, the farther I think he's going to fall behind. Who knows? Maybe tomorrow we'll see the announcement that he is running. Who knows?
Yeah, right.
Eric, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you.
Hey, wonderful to be on the show, and thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Eric Loomis, professor, historian, and blogger over at Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Highly suggested also the book America in 10 Strikes. Quick break, right back. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show.